Welcome to A Lust for Life's new parenting podcast series. I'm your host, Ciara O'Connor-Walsh. A Lust for Life is a mental health charity on a mission to educate and empower the children and young people of Ireland through early prevention mental health programmes, content and advocacy. And we also want to support the adults in our children and young people's lives, parents, teachers, guardians and friends, by giving you the tools that you need to be that one good adult in a child's life. And that is what this podcast is all about. So join us as we explore the joys and challenges and complexities of parenthood through compassionate conversations, interviews, and real-life parenting stories. We're here to provide you with practical tips, support, and resources to help you parent with a little more ease and to nurture both your child's and your own mental health. So welcome, Mally. I'm so delighted to talk to you today. And I wanted to talk to you, first of all, about your book, because this book, the day it arrived in the post, was the day I needed it. I think I read it in about 2 days. I just devoured it. And if you don't mind, I might just read, like it's very well thumbed over and loved, but I might just start by reading just a short passage that I think really sums up the essence of the book, or a part of it at least. So this is from Love In, Love Out. Because our inner voice has such huge power over how we feel about ourselves and how we make sense of and respond to our experiences, compassionate mantras like Love In, Love Out balance the negative inner voice we often tune into during our hardest moments. Many of us, and especially parents, are grandmasters at beating ourselves up at every opportunity we get. Being nice to ourselves may feel really alien to some of us. It's as if that we think being hard on ourselves will keep us in line and make us better parents. But on the contrary, being self-critical doesn't prevent bad things from happening and can actually make things worse for both us and our kids. And I loved that. And I know there's like this sort of cliche of like, you have to start with yourself and put your own oxygen mask on. But I feel like that book takes that cliche of tending to yourself first and goes really deep with it and really teaches you the tools, because we were never taught these tools, how to look after yourself, how to have compassion for yourself in difficult moments. But it's particularly focused on parenting anxious children. And I thought we might start there, if that's okay, just to talk about what is it like to parent an anxious child. And how do you find in the parents that you deal with that it shows up differently for different parents? Or how does it differ from like a typical childhood parenting experience?
Thanks, Ciara, for having me on and for reading that. I mean, listen, we're all going to parent an anxious child at some point. It's not like the book that I wrote is about a particular child. I think as human beings, we all experience anxiety. And I think we just need to, I suppose, come to accept that, because our brains are very much focused on threat to keep us safe. So therefore, anxiety is a byproduct of that. And that is, all of us are going to experience that at some point. So really, you know, I don't think it's a case of, you know, we're not trying to get rid of anxiety. Yes, we're trying to help to manage if a child is present, you know, has anxious moments. You know, at the moment, I'll tell you, I am parenting an anxious child to an extent. There's anxiety going on and there's strife going on in our household. And we have a particular child who's more sensitive. And I think because she feels it, then that presents as finding it difficult to go to sleep at night, hearing noises, she's 10, you know, being afraid. And I think, and that's what happened to me when I was a kid, and is the reason I wrote the book, is because I suppose like strifes in families are inevitable. You know, like our current one is about, you know, looking after elderly, sick grandparents. But strifes are inevitable. And I think some children, they say about 15%, 15%, of children and adults have a more anxious disposition. And so therefore, when stuff is happening, or when, you know, something happens at school or any type of traumatic event, then it can ignite this sense of anxiety where certain situations become more threat provoking. And that can be really difficult for parents to deal with. You know, I was only talking to a parent this morning about, you know, her child getting to the school door, getting up the stairs and then freezing and saying, I'm not going in there today, mommy, you know. And what happens is, and this happened to me last night as well, when my daughter came down the stairs and says, I'm not able to go to sleep, even though her sister was actually in the room with her. Her sister was asleep and we had, you know, asked her sister to go in with her last night. We as parents are faced with this, they're in this fight or flight situation when they're feeling, you know, perceiving a threat. And then when parents are faced with a situation like that, we go into our fight or flight system and we freeze. And it's like, I don't know what to do. Like that parent this morning was like, I don't know what to do when she says she's not going in. It's kind of like, you know, the amygdala hijack of your child, which is, you know, the threat focus part of your brain meets the amygdala hijack of the parent. And then it's like two headless chickens, do you know? So it's really hard. So I suppose the whole idea behind my book, Love In, Love Out, was that how can we somehow build in this sense of like, sense of self-reflection almost for parents, that awareness that they go into fight or flight mode, and how can we increase that space between what happens and how we react to what happens. And I think that's where the self-compassion comes in. That's where filling our cup a little bit, even checking in with, where is my nervous system at right now? How am I reacting in this situation? And like last night, my nervous system went into overdrive. And it was only my husband, who was calmer in that moment, who said, oh, it's OK, Amy, just go back up the stairs. I'll sit on the stairs looking at my phone and you can just go to sleep that way. It was like 10:30 at night, 11 o'clock. We were dying for her to just get to sleep. So sometimes how do we recruit that more rational side of our brain? So we will all, in answer to your question and a long way, Kira, is that we will all parent an anxious child at a certain point, and that we will all feel the anxiety in response to our child as well.
I can really relate to that because I grew up a very anxious child myself. And then my little boy is very anxious, and it's so hard not to get, I mean, like I've spent like the project of trying to fix my anxiety or at least try and have tools to support myself for my whole life. But then when he was born, like, God, it's very triggering because it's the most primal part of you just wants to protect your child. And when you see something playing out that you suffered with as a child yourself, I find that personally, and I see my friends who struggle with it as well, with an anxious child, it's very hard to watch them go through it and stay in that good regulated place yourself.
It really, I totally agree, Kira. It's and like I didn't even realize it in that way. And then add on the fact that my husband turns around to me at other moments and says, you wrote a book on it. You should know how to manage. And I'm just like,
thanks, great.
But it's my child. And I'm like, well, you didn't even read my book. But like, it's so hard when they're your own child. And sometimes you just feel like you're out of options, or you don't know, you know, like that mom this morning, do I encourage and push my child to remain in school, or what do I do? And so we kind of just focused on what can help in that very moment. So sometimes, you know, like I kind of mentioned, maybe the child could bring in like a little sensory toy in their pocket that they could squeeze on as they go to school so that there's something ready for them. I just got a tattoo lately of a figure of eight because that's one of my kind of anchoring strategies. When we are in this fight or flight mode, we are releasing our cortisol, adrenaline. So we need to anchor ourselves to safety. The parent can do that with the child. In fact, that will help the parent to calm as well. So what we can do is with our index finger on our arm, or a child can actually do this in school, without being noticed, with their toe on the ground under their seat, is that we breathe in for the top part of the eight, 1, 2, 3, 4. We pause in the middle, And then we breathe out for the bottom part of the eight. One, two, three, four, pause. So that's kind of like what I call an anchoring strategy, that you can kind of, when the child is calm, you can figure out a few little ways that might help them. Another thing, when you're in public, you can kind of do these shaking strategies where you're like shaking the cortisol out. But I think, you know, one of the things that, one of the learnings that I had that I didn't realize is that when children are anxious, not only are they releasing adrenaline and cortisol, which are stress hormones, but they're releasing oxytocin, which is the bonding hormone. So they're literally recruiting you for support, even though in that moment you're like, oh, I don't know what to do. And you're being triggered maybe because of your own anxiety as a child and all the different things. Or else you haven't, you're hungry, angry, lonely, tired yourself in that moment. You haven't eaten, you're tired, you're so the fact that they're like recruiting us for support. And I'm not trying to make parents feel guilty here, because I'm always harping on, Kira, about good enough parenting, which is a third of the time we're tuning in, everything's going okay, and we're getting each other's messages. A third of the time is rupture, where we're really just not tuning in together. And a third of the time is repair. Like the rupture could look something like, oh my God, I don't know what to do. I don't know what else to try now, you know, with you going to bed. That would have been me last night. And then a repair might be, okay, Amy, just let me have a wee think about it now. I just need to put my little thinking hat on and we're just going to breathe together. Maybe we'll get a little glass of milk just to kind of even take the urgency out of the situation and trying to figure out a plan of what might help in that moment. But again, playful things always help as well. You know, sometimes when kids are afraid of monsters before bed, that you might have like a monster spray and say, let's spray this monster spray. Or, do you know, with younger kids, that can work really well. Or else doing, I said this to a parent this morning about reverse psychology. So it's like, I'll go to bed with you and I'll sit with you and you tell me when you want me to go. So the child is initiating the separation. And then they'll say, you can go. I've had this with my daughter. You can go now, mommy.
Oh, I'm stealing that. Gosh,
yeah, so when she feels safe and regulated, she can tell me to go. Now, parents are afraid to do that because they're like, oh my God, my kid will never let me go. But like, they will, they will. It's just, it's about creating that regulation in the moment. You know, like, what can we do to calm this right down? And it's okay. My reasoning head should have told me last night, it's okay if she stays up an extra 10, 15 minutes until we figure out a plan. But thankfully, my husband came in that moment. But we don't always have someone to come in. So it's about trying to figure out plans even when we're not in that moment, if you know what I mean. And that's why self-care comes in, because it's very hard for us as parents to use our rational brains if we haven't eaten, if we haven't gone on a little walk today, if we've just literally burnt ourselves out and then we go from 0 to 100 without even realizing.
Mm. Yeah, I think there's always an opportunity to come back from that. And I think that's why what you mentioned there about repair, and I think it might have been in your book, but I'd heard it as well, I think somewhere else, you know, that repair is just this wonderful opportunity for you to just model, you know, saying sorry to your kids if you don't show up in the way that you wanted to. So anytime I ever like blow my lid because I'm burnt out and I'm exhausted and I've just reached the end of my tether and the boys are drive me up the walls and I just go and I have a moment, I will always go back to them and I'll say, hey, I'm really sorry. I shouldn't have shouted or I shouldn't have snapped at you. I was actually worried about an email that I got from work, which was like totally different and nothing to do with you. So I shouldn't have. It was wrong for me to take it out on you. And I always find those moments, they look at you really quizzically like, huh, okay. Like, you're fallible, you're not like this god figure that gets everything right. I think that's really healthy.
I think repair, as I say, you know, because I'm so interested in babies' mental health and early mental health, is like it's literally your brain, you are kind of nurturing your child's brain connections by repairing in that moment, because they will realize A, that you're human, and B, that like, you know, like the ruptures happen, but we can repair them. Do you know what I mean? And so they will expect that from relationships in the future. So you will, they will more likely have healthy relationships where repair happens. And if they meet somebody in the future that doesn't say sorry for something, then they're less likely to want to accept that. But it's literally, it is the fertile ground upon which healthy brain connections are made. And a repair, as you said, Kira, like, you know, sometimes parents repair and they say, well, you know, I'm sorry that I shouted, but you shouldn't have blah, blah, blah. Like, a but doesn't belong in a repair, right? We all do it sometimes. But there can be a learning moment at a future time where, you know, or else we say in psychology about catching a child being good. So I don't really like the words being good. But what I mean by that is when your child is doing something that you like, then you tell them that. Do you know what I mean? And that, so the, yeah, the repair, like, it's so important, Kira. And I think it's kind of a generational thing, though. I don't know if that was done when we were kids. I mean, it just feels beautiful when you just kind of tune back in again and just knowing that these, of course, we can learn from these things, though. Like, I know that, you know, I have a lot to learn, and but we all have a lot to learn, I suppose. And just kind of knowing that good enough parenting is when we're kind of getting it, trying to get it right as such, 2/3 of the time, that rupture is part of it as well. And in fact, ruptures help our children to build resilience, because resilience is all about facing a threat with a soothing presence by our side. So if children don't experience any ruptures or threats as they grow, as they, you know, grow older, then they're going to like turn 18 and not know how to deal with a difficulty. So like you could say that anxiety and the things that they're afraid about are threats for them now. And it's about kind of how can we help them to build up their coping tools for coping with that threat? Because that's what anxiety is. We overestimate threat and we underestimate our ability to cope with it. So how can we make the threat seem a bit smaller and make the coping seem a bit bigger so that those can meet? That's really what you're trying to get the balance of.
That's amazing, isn't it? I've heard people say to put a worry, or the right size worry in the right size jar. That's something I just heard somebody say before, you know. So if you're worried about like a tiger attacking you in the middle of the night, you say, well, that's actually, the likelihood of that happening is very small. So we can put that in quite a small worry jar, you know.
I love that.
Which I really liked, actually stuck with me. And I often will say that to Ezzy. So it's kind of resizing the worry and saying, but if that did happen, like, you know, here's what you can do.
And that's lovely, because it kind of coincides with the worry box, you know, like where you get children to like, you know, get a shoebox and they might write a few worries down or draw them and put them into a box. And maybe once a week or twice a week, you might look in the box and take out the worry and talk about it. Maybe not just before bedtime, but, you know, during like a period they feel a little bit safer during the day. And then if it's not a worry anymore, you can tear it up. If it is a worry still, you can rate it out of 10, put the date next to it, and then go back to it in a few weeks. But equally, some kids are worried about stuff. There's this really good book called The Big Bag of Worries. I'm sure you've seen it before.
I haven't, yeah. It's great.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And like, so Amy mightn't realize at the moment I'm talking about her now. She's be like, stop talking about me on your podcast. But she mightn't realize that she's picking up on additional anxiety in the household at the moment, right? So like, but if a child is conscious of, well, I worry that, you know, we don't have enough money, or I worry that mommy, you know, something's gonna, you know, about mommy's job or about daddy's this, or you can kind of say to your child with that example you use that I'm gonna carry that worry box for you, that imaginary jar. Or you know what I mean? That's not a jar you need to carry. And that's why with the worry box, very often when we're doing that with kids, and if anybody wants any of these recommendations, you can contact me via my website and I'll send them to you. But what's really good about that is children, to kind of keep the box, I suppose, in your bedroom so that you're trying to help them to share the load. Because sometimes that's what worries are in a way, Kira. It's like an anxiety. It's like our mind gets very narrow, and we, you know, when we're encountering a threat, and it's like everything just, it just sticks into our minds like, oh my God, I have this to worry about and that to worry about and all these different things. But it's actually in the break, you can break that cycle, I suppose, by standing up, trying to look out at a horizon somewhere and taking two deep breaths in through your nose and a big breath out through your mouth. And that's kind of like the power of regulating ourselves and using our visual sense to look at a horizon and to see that there's so much more to the world than what's in our heads. And figuring out, there's lots of other strategies online for adults, like about, is this a necessary worry? Is this a, do you know, can I do something about it now or not? Those kinds of little techniques that can be used.
And just picking up on, you know, the types of worries, I think one of the biggest type of worries, just in myself and my friends who are parenting at the same time, the same age children, one of the things we all seem to find the hardest is the worries that are out of our control. And it's funny, when you're parenting little babies and toddlers, like, you're in control of their entire environment. And, you know, you can make sure that they have everything, you know, exactly as you would want it, and that you're living in according to your values and everything is lovely. And then they start to go to school and they start to do this very natural, you know, developmental thing of breaking slowly away from you. But they also build relationships outside of the immediate family and community that you have. And that's where you can get really difficult situations arising, like bullying or difficult friendships or being left out and all of these things that cause your child worry. And you go from this like kind of full control situation, you know, where you can help your child with literally everything, to a situation where there are things that are out of your control as a parent. And you are then kind of thrust into this, it's kind of makes me certainly even more anxious as a parent, because I start imagining all the things that are happening when I'm not there and, you know, all of that. So how do you manage worries your child has about like big things they're navigating, like school and bullying and all of that sort of stuff?
Through your relationship, you know, like the first sentence in my book is not mine, but it's from Bessel van der Kolk. And he basically says the child-parent connection is the most powerful mental health intervention known to mankind. Do you know, like, I couldn't come up with a quote as good as that. But literally it is, I was only writing this for, because I'm working on the Lust for Life Schools program, as you know. And it was really exciting this morning because I was doing up information for junior and senior infants all about the importance of the child-parent connection and the attachment relationship that really, like, I suppose it's about trusting, you know, that the building blocks that you have put in during their early years, when their brain was developing at a massive rate, you know, like they say up to 90% of the brain develops in the first 3 years of life. Like, that is incredible. Of course, there's many other periods of brain development as we get older, of course. But, you know, trusting, I guess, and how do we build that trust? That's another thing. But trusting that relationship that you have built, the tuning in, the rupture, the repair, the nurturing your child's exploration of the world. So if you're looking at attachment theory is all about the connection between the parent and the child. And in a diagram, you could say that they're either going out to explore their world, which is exactly what you're saying there about, you know, going to school. You know, my 12, 13 year old is going to town for the first time herself with friends now. Those kinds of things that you cannot, going on a bus for herself, those kinds of things. So exploring their world, or else they're coming back in looking for comfort. And literally that's the way we are with our parents for all our lives, really, but particularly when we're kids, obviously. So what do we need to do when they're going out of the circle to explore their world? We need to support them in that exploration, you know, but of course we also need to make sure that proper precautions are there in terms of safety, right? Because I mean, everywhere we hear something negative, you know, if you put on the news for long enough, you'll be scared about everything. So it's about trying to figure out what is a healthy level of exploration for my child and how do I manage my feelings around that? Because, you know, in my book, I also talk about shark music. if you have a difficulty with your child going out and exploring their world, right? It could be that one of your parents had a difficulty with you doing that. And you are feeling what they felt, if you know what I mean. It has been transmitted to you because you might have gone up on a play frame and one of your parents might have been like, Kira, get down, stop. I don't know. Or, you know, it could have been anything, or there could have been a lot of worry for, and I'm not trying to analyze you here, but I'm just saying that we pick up on our parents' ways of parenting in an unconscious way without even trying. I know we might say, oh, I don't want to be anything like my parents, but you are going to be. You either are going to be, or you're going to try to be the flip opposite, which is still a result of their parenting, if you know what I mean. So we're literally, you're parenting right now, and every listener out there is parenting with the baggage of multiple generations of parents' parenting styles. So that's why I kind of say the most important thing in all of that is developing self-awareness and even looking at that attachment model. The child is either going out to explore their world or they're coming back in looking for comfort. Which part of that do you find hardest? Do you find it hardest when your child goes and explores their world? Do you find it hardest when they come back in looking for comfort? And by the way, coming back in looking for comfort could mean, as a teenager, telling you to get out of their room, do you know? Or it could be a tantrum on the floor of Pennies. It could be any of those. It's emotional regulation. So it's trying to just figure out, and a great book for that is called The Circle of Security. It's a parenting training I did years ago, which really, I was meant to become a facilitator in it, which I did, but I just learned so much about my own blind spots. And this idea, this shark music idea, is this whole like echoes of your childhood wounds. When you parent, I'm sure you catch yourself sometimes, Kira, going, oh my God, I just sounded exactly like my mom or my dad or whatever, do you know?
For sure. And I think every generation of parents tries to sort of slough off the bad stuff, you know, and do things a little bit differently. But again, because that it's so instinctive of us to behave, to rear our children how we were reared, like in most cultures around the world, apart from the Western world, you know, you would just do it exactly the way your grandparents do it, your mother did it, your aunties and uncles, everyone in the village. Now there's all these parenting styles. You have to adopt a philosophy and an ideology around parenting, you know. And I think that that's where self-compassion comes in. And I want to ask you about self-compassion now, because for me, I think one of the greatest gifts self-compassion has brought to me is it's almost like an antidote to perfection. And I grew up definitely feeling like I would have quite high strung tendencies and be quite perfectionistic. But my God, is our culture a culture of perfection? Like, we're looking around at social media and, you know, other people parenting and their children living perfect lives, and everything seems to be going so smoothly, and they're baking bread and sourdough, and you know what I mean? It's like this barrage of like people living these beautiful lives, whereas you're like trying to keep your head above water and trying to keep all the plates spinning and working and kids and, you know, really bringing that self-compassion piece and that good enough parenting and, you know, bringing that level of forgiveness to yourself is the opposite of that, I feel.
Totally. I mean, I feel the same as you, Kira. Like, I'm definitely, like, I was an anxious child. I am quite a perfectionist. I don't think my parents made me that way. It's just the way, it's just in my makeup. I can't even blame them for that. So for me, when I found self-compassion, the whole kind of compassion literature a few years ago, I was like, oh my God, this is just gold, because it's all about understanding how the brain works. Like, why? I call it like our culture is like everything is like the perfect storm. So we've got this brain that's focused on threat and what we don't have. We're comparing ourselves to other parents. We're always feeling like we don't quite measure up, even though we're just looking at their highlight reels on Instagram or whatever it is. Then we've also got this negativity bias where we're kind of looking at the negative more than the positive. And then, you know, that's just what's going on in your brain. And then you have what's coming at you from the outside. So like, I didn't want, when I wrote my book, I totally didn't want it to be like, here's another parenting guide on these are the things you should be doing. I didn't want that. Like, if there was one message that came from it, it was like, you are not alone. Look, I had a SHIT hard parenting moment last night. I do it every day. I struggle as a parent. I struggle as a person in this world. And it's okay. It's okay. Do you know what I mean? And, you know, the three elements of self-compassion are common humanity is the first one. It's this idea of like, we all struggle as human beings. You're not alone. Somebody else in this world right now is feeling the feelings you are. It's like COVID really brought that to the fore, like that we all can struggle sometimes. And even though your struggle is individual to you in this moment, it does help to know you're not alone, because we're social species and we need to know. Sometimes even a 5-minute chat with someone can help you feel less alone, or even just listening to a podcast like this going, oh my God, those two women, you know, who seem to have it together are saying like, they're just like messes. As we say, like, as Glennon Doyle says, we're all kind of like perfect messes. Let's just stop pretending to be perfect and let's just be messy together. Do you know? That's common humanity. And then the second aspect of compassion-focused therapy is this idea of mindfulness, which is like, you know, it's the self-awareness of this is how I'm feeling right now in this moment. So my child has just said, I can't go to sleep or whatever. There's a monster in the room or whatever's going on. This is how I'm feeling in this moment. I'm checking in with my nervous system. I'm feeling frustrated. I'm feeling frozen. I'm feeling angry. I'm hungry. I'm this, that, or the other. And it's kind of like accepting the way you feel in that moment without judging it, because when we judge our feelings, we make it 10 times worse. So if we're like, I should be more understanding, or I should be this, like just accept what you are in that moment. You don't have to act from there, but it's just to kind of be aware of it. And then if you bring a breath in and out, things might just soothe out a little bit. And so that's what mindfulness in it is, awareness of how you're feeling and without judgment. And then finally, the self-kindness comes in. And it's self-kindness for me. It's an attitude. It's kind of like a way of being with yourself, being aware of that critical voice that says you're not good enough. We all have that voice. We're not trying to get rid of the voice. The voice is there to keep us safe. We're trying to turn the volume down on the voice. Turn the volume up on a kinder voice. And sometimes it can be bringing humor in. So like, I remember going to a training where they said, you can lose your keys in two ways. You can lose your keys in a very self-deprecating way, which I do very often, which is like, for God's sake, where are my keys? You're such an idiot, Maddie. I can't believe you lost your keys. This is probably what my kids see me do every morning. Or else you can lose your keys in a comical kind of like, kind of almost like self-deprecating, like, oh, my keys are not where they should be. what a crazy thing that happened to me yesterday and the day before. But anyway, I will find them. Let me just think of what jacket or what bag I last wore. And you're kind of doing it in a calmer, playful way, which actually it's basically saying, you know, it's not ideal that you've lost your keys. And that was maybe a silly thing to do, but rather than that makes you a terrible person. Do you know what I'm saying? So like so that's the attitude of self-compassion. But then we talk about self-compassion practices, which are more like what I call compassionate self-care. And I have a lovely exercise for this in my book called The Lotus of Self-Care, another tattoo edition I've had in the last few years. And basically that's, how do you fill your cup? So we have 5 aspects of well-being, like physical and psychological and spiritual and social and emotional. So how do you fill your cup in each of these areas? And is there something tangible you can do on a daily basis to just refill your cup a little bit? And it could be something as simple as I'm going to eat 3 regular meals, or I'm going to make sure that I get to sleep on time, or I'm going to stop looking at social media when it's making me feel like crap. It could be, you know, making decisions, even the no decisions are as important as the yes decisions.
Yeah, and I think people sometimes get overwhelmed when they hear like, oh, self-care, and they go, oh my God, when? Like, I when know. Am I going to do self-care? And what does that look like? How much am I going to have to spend on face creams? Do you know? And I think it becomes another job. And, you know, me and my husband always joke, you know, just say, I'm just going to go and hide in the toilet. And
yeah, that's self-care.
I used to like think it was, I'm going to hide in the toilet. I'm hiding in the toilet for my children. Like, what is wrong with me?
Yeah.
And normal. Now I go, this is my self-care. Or we also do this thing, supermarket cocktail hour, where if we're overwhelmed, you go, I need to go to the shop. I'm going for a supermarket cocktail hour. And you just go to the shop by yourself. That, if you're having a really maxed out parenting day, sometimes that's all you can do for yourself is give yourself like 20 minutes walking around little in peace. Do you know?
Absolutely, because it your nervous system can be reset so fast. And that's why we talk about the breathing in and the breathing out. It's like, you know, I talked before about giving one of my daughters a shower. I won't name her again. And anyway, it's like, you know, her screaming and shouting and hating the shower years ago, thankfully a bit better now. But literally the best thing I could do in that moment, and I've done it not the best way many times, is just breathe in and out as she's shouting, screaming, because in that moment, if I react, I will flip my lid as such. So I just need to breathe and regulate myself. Then that'll kind of, it's almost like holding a baby and you're calming your breathing. And then your child instinctively feels that, even if they're not, if you're not holding them in that moment, they know at every moment of every day where your nervous system is at. So it's literally, we do that. We regulate with everybody's nervous systems when they walk into a room. So it's like whatever it takes in that moment. And in that moment, if I couldn't continue the shower, obviously, like for me, the regulation was in the breath. But there's other times where you just need to leave the room, or like I need to, or make decisions. Like when I used to work away from home, rather than park at home, I would park near my house so that I wouldn't come in the door, because I knew I'd be pounced on immediately. I would park near my house and go for a little loop of the green before coming in, because I, by God, I tell you, I was a much nicer mommy coming in 5 minutes later than if I had done it 5 minutes earlier. So we're not talking about face creams and chocolate baths, and although chocolate baths, there's a quote that says chocolate and salt baths. I love a chocolate bath. But you know what I'm saying? It's like it's basically regulation moments. They're self-regulation moments, whatever they are.
Yeah, and you need to do that. And look, one of the things that I absolutely love about your book is that a huge chunk of it is actually about action. It's about things that you can do. And I love that during this conversation, you've just been peppering it through with practical stuff, because you can read loads of theory about parenting, and there's a million parenting books out there, as you said, and there's a million experts in parenting, and they're like, this is the one way, and this is the, you know, this is attachment parenting, and this is this parenting and that parenting, and this is the way to do it. But never really gives you much in the way of examples, like real life things you can do tomorrow with your child to deepen that parent-child connection, that being the cornerstone. And I just love that the idea of that love in, love out. That's the main thing that you can do as a parent, is put that love in, which is just so gorgeous. One of the things that I love that you highlighted is the power of play. And I'm just a big believer in the power of play. And I just think children don't get enough time to have unstructured play in their lives. And I'm always trying to facilitate that more at home. I find it a bit tricky when there's like screens and Nintendo Switches to be played and you know, and drama class and all of the other things that they end up going to have that time for play. Like, how can we try and carve a bit more of that time out? Because it is so, well, maybe you might say a bit about why play is important, and then how can we make more time for it?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose play is like a child's bread and butter. You know, it's their everything. They learn about their environment through play. So through play with you, that can really nurture your connection between you and your child. And it's, you know, yeah, of course, like, for instance, in our Lust for Life schools program at the moment, we're talking about like how, you know, you can engage in child led play and get down on the floor and do moments of even 5-10 minutes of play with your child. I mean, last night I played rummy with my children on the floor. Now, I'm not trying to, it was for 10 minutes. It was a quick brief, but it was our chance to just like have a laugh. and they taught me this game. I still don't know do we have the rules right, but it's just like, it's that, it's the connection through play when it's done with your child. But children need periods of unstructured play. And I know, like, our world has very much gone towards the idea of play dates where they're supervised all the time. And but it's really important. Like, I remember Hillary Clinton talking about, like, where she learned the power of negotiation was through being out with her friends when she was younger and there was a problem and they had to sort it out, and it was kids together. But our kids are getting that in their playgrounds and schools, thankfully. Like, they, when I love watching kids in playgrounds, and in, you know, I have to do that as part of my job, you know, to observe a child and to see how they so naturally, you know, like my 10-year-old, a friend of hers will come up to her and go tag, and that just starts a game of tag. I just think it's beautiful to see kids. So I guess it is important, but I don't want parents to think, oh, like, it's crucial, but I don't want parents to think, oh my God, I'm not, you know, I'm worried too that my kids are on screens too much. You know what I mean? It's the world that we live in. Sometimes it's easier for them to be on a screen when we're busy. But I kind of try to, you know, go, right, okay, in my head, they're going to be on the screen for maybe an hour at this point or whatever. That's not to say they only get an hour, because they get more, but it's like, then we'll do something else, or else I'll say to them, will you, look, you got that great book, will you read that book for a while, or help me to do such and such, or whatever it is, go outside if you live in an area where it is good if they can go outside as well and play with friends without adults being there all the time, or go up to their rooms and play with their friends. Whatever it is they engage in is hugely important, because, like, I talk about play, like, I trained as a in-play therapy after doing my clinical training, but play is the opposite of fear. So if you bring play, you can't be fearful and playful at the same time. So it's the same for an adult. You're not going to be, like, worried about this, that, and the other and be playing at the same time. So it's like, it literally opens this, it's the antidote to fear. And that's why bringing in playful strategies like, you know, sensory toys, you know, for kids that are worried going on their way to school, are, you know, using the monster spray and really getting into your child's world when they're worried about a monster. Bringing in the power of stories as well as, you know, reading a story together. Play just regulates our systems. And it's the same with adults together and, like, dancing. And that's why I love, like, drama and all those things. You can't be watching a show and immersed in it and be anxious, you know? So it's like, this is good for our systems. And it is worrying, I suppose, in a way, because with play reducing now compared to the way things were 30 years ago when I was growing up, kids feel less of a sense of self-efficacy, self-control. You know, like, they feel, they've studied kids and their sense of feeling a control over their lives. And they say that when you don't get as many opportunities to play freely without adults, you have less opportunities to build this self-resilience. Do you know what I mean? This idea of being able to cope with things. So it's about trying to, like, balance that out as parents. And one piece of advice that I got from, I don't know from where, but it was this idea of, let your child do something new tomorrow that you didn't let them do today. Not necessarily in a very unsafe way. You're obviously going to figure out what that is. But, you know, I kind of feel like, even like in our household, we do way too much for the kids. So, you know, like, getting them to help you do stuff, you know, use a knife for the first time, you know, go out, let them go to the shop for the first time, obviously in an age, you know, appropriate way, enabling them to do stuff, because it's only through them doing the stuff themselves that they're going to learn to feel kind of in control and able to do it.
Yeah. And they feel so proud as well. It's so sweet. Like, my little boys went into the shop. It was just only the other day I was like, why don't you guys go into the shop and I'll give you the money. to go and buy whatever. And they're 6 and 4, like they're not that
old. That's so cute.
But they were like, yeah, we could do that, no problem. Yeah. So anyway, they went off in and I sneaked out of the car and I was looking in and I made eye contact with the cashier and I was like, just gave her the nod. And they had my card to tap it and everything. And they just did everything perfectly. And then as I saw them coming, I ran back to the car and was like, do, pretended I had just been sitting there the whole time. And they got in, they were like, we did it. We bought the things and we got everything. They were so proud of themselves. And it reminds me of that thing that you were saying about, you know, they go out to explore and then they come back. And sometimes they come back with treasures and excitement and they want to show and you to rejoice with them in all of the things they learned and explored. And then sometimes they come back and they just need a soft place to land.
Yeah. First time my daughter went to the shop herself, I got her to get me some milk. But she was with her friend and she came and apparently on their way home from the shop, they dropped the milk and it exploded. So they had to figure out what were they going to do. I think they put the milk in the bin and I think they may have had enough money to buy another milk. But it was just even that figuring out.
Yeah.
Holy crap. What are we going to do now? Do you know what I mean? So it's like, unless they're given those opportunities, then those mishaps aren't going to happen either. So it's like you're trying to give them the opportunity, but and then they can come back to you. One of the things you did there, Kira, was you delighted in your children. So one of the most important things as parents that we do when they're going out to explore their world and coming back in looking for comfort, we delight in them. So that is how children build a sense of kind of self-esteem, a sense of being worthwhile in the world when they're delighted in. It's these serve and return interactions where a child looks at you and they go, or that your children came back into the car and said, Mommy, we did it. We went into the shop and we bought such and such. And the big man said, blah, blah, blah. And you're like, oh my God, that's brilliant. Well done. That's fantastic. My goodness. And you're using your tone of voice. You're looking at them. It's using all of these like expressions to show them that they are worthy, that they are important. And you're doing that when they're also going through hard times, you know. And one of the things about when they're going through hard times is I love this idea as a parent's role is to organize their child's feelings. And I just love that because organize sounds so like relaxing. We're just organizing their feelings. So when your child is having the tantrum in pennies, or when your teenager is telling you to get the hell out of their room, how am I going to organize their feelings here? And it's about regulation. And we can't organize our kids' feelings unless our feelings are organized themselves. So I love that whole circle of security and that whole attachment way of looking at things is hugely important.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Mally. And that was like, I've kept you for nearly an hour now. So I really appreciate how practical you were, you know, in just giving loads of examples and everything. And one of the big takeaways I found from the book and every time I talk to you as well is that I just feel like there's not much to be done, only just show up in the most authentic way that you can with your kids. And, you know, just that bringing that sense of self-compassion to every interaction is one of the most healing things you can do. So I just want to thank you for how your book helped me to just be more forgiving towards myself and more patient with myself as a parent. And also just not to expect to be perfect in every interaction and that that's healthy and normal as well. And that we're just doing our best for our kids. And, you know, I think it's really important to say that like every child is going to be an anxious child at one point or another as well. So we're all going to be parents of anxious children at some point. That's only normal.
Yeah, absolutely, Kira. And just to know, like if some of this is very triggering for you, then I would always say, I suppose, you know, get the supports that you need from your family and friends. But if you like, I've gone back to therapy lately because I felt I needed another dose of it as such. It's okay to go and speak to someone professional about this stuff or to get some support, you know, particularly if you have these echoes of these childhood wounds that are resurfacing right now for whatever reason that is. That's okay. Do you know? So, yeah, I guess you're not alone. And that's kind of the most important way I would look at it. And if anybody wants to contact me on my website and they want any resources or anything like that, I'll send them whatever, and they can look me up as well, because I've done quite a bit on, you know, in terms of media stuff on it. So yeah, webinars and things that are just there out there for people for free.
That's great. Well, Mally, thank you so much for the work that you do and the work that you do for A Lust for Life as well. Mally is designing our primary schools program at the moment for junior and senior infants, and is going to be working on our secondary schools program as well, starting out with first years. And we're hopefully going to have our program available right up until leave and certs as well, to support young people and give them the skills and tools that they need to be able to be well in themselves and deepen their connection with others. So thank you so much for everything that you do and for being an amazing resource for parents. And yeah, we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you to all our listeners for joining us for this parenting podcast at A Lust for Life. We are committed to providing free, valuable resources and support to children and young people and families like yours, but we can't do it alone. If you found our podcast helpful and informative, please consider supporting our work by making a donation. To donate or learn more about our schools, programs or campaigns, visit alustforlife.ie. Every donation, no matter how small, helps us reach more children with our early intervention programs in schools. Join us on the journey to change the face of mental health in Ireland. Thanks for listening.